Our second speaker this morning is Brother Mark Vincent from the Lapworth UK Ecclesia. The theme for Brother Mark's classes this week is Conquest, Joshua and the Canaanites. Today's class is entitled An Altar of Imposing Size. Brother Mark.
Today, then, is the day of goodbyes, and no doubt there will be handshakes and hugs and perhaps a tear here and there as well. And that's how it is for us after just a week of being together at Bible school. It was a time for goodbyes for Israel too in Joshua 22. And here it was not a matter of them having been together for a few days. They had camped together for weeks, for months, for years even. They had fought side by side. They had seen the walls of Jericho fall down together and they had run up to take possession of the city. These would have been close relationships, wouldn't they? These would have been special relationships. And this point of parting now in Joshua 22 would have been a time of sadness, no doubt, and a time of remembering all the things that, with God's help, they had been able to achieve in his sight. At that time, Joshua summoned the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And we noticed, hadn't we, when we began our studies, way back whenever that was on Monday, in chapter 1, how one of the themes in that little that list of themes that we've got, that index of themes that we've got in Joshua 1, we noted that one of the themes was the east and the west, didn't we? That Joshua was at pains to specifically address the 2.5 tribes to ensure that all the tribes of Israel were united together in the mission that they had to accomplish. None was to take it easy while the others bore the brunt of the work. They were to be in this together. And now, correspondingly, that theme finds its place at various points in the book. And now, as we draw to the close of the book in chapter 22, the east and west theme comes to the fore again, as Joshua now addresses the 2.5 tribes before they say their goodbyes and head back across the Jordan to take the territory that God had given to them. So let's have a look at what Joshua says to them in verse 2. Joshua said to them, "You have kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and have obeyed my voice in all that I have commanded you. You have not forsaken your brothers these many days down to this day, but have been careful to keep the charge of the Lord your God." Isn't that a wonderful thing? There's nothing negative to say here, is there? This is all commendation. This is all celebration of the wonderful faith that these brothers had shown to their brothers in this service to God. They've obeyed the voice, they've listened to the commandment, and they've sought to put it in practice. Unfortunately, as we'll go on to see in the chapter, the fact that they've done so well and it's all been so good to this point doesn't mean that there isn't danger of things starting to go wrong. And that's going to happen, isn't it, as we know, because we've read this chapter before. But for the moment, let's just take time to savor the joy of having been able to participate in the great works that God has been accomplishing, to have our part to play in that work. And now, verse 4, "The Lord has given rest to your brothers, as he promised them. Therefore turn and go to your tents in the land where your possession lies, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of Jordan." And these are all the words of chapter 1, aren't they, here? And I won't draw them out one by one, but you know, you could circle them and you could trace them back to the start of the book. "Only be very careful to observe the commandment and the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, to love the Lord your God and to walk in all his ways and to keep his commandments and to cling to him and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul." So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their tents. Just a couple of things for us to note here. In verse 5, "Only be very careful to observe the commandments of and the law that Moses commanded you." This carefulness that he encourages them to show. We're going to come back to that in a moment when we get into chapters 23 and 24, but it's just worth noting that it's here as well. We all need to take care. And then he goes on to elaborate, doesn't he? He goes on to elaborate what the commandment and the law that he's described, the commandment and the law that we should be very careful to observe, he goes on to expand on what that is in verse 6. It's not verse 6, it's the second half of verse 5. Do you see that? The commandment and the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and then he expands that. And it's like a five-point plan. And I just think all of the verbs here, all of these commands, are just really helpful ones for us to remember. You know, maybe these are the sorts of things to put on a poster or on the wall somewhere, or to keep as a checklist in your Bible. Or in your wallet or something, to remind us of our responsibilities. Number one, to love the Lord your God. Number two, to walk in all his ways. Number three, to keep his commandments. And number four, to cling to him. And number five, to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. What a great set of commandments for us to keep as a memorial of our responsibilities. And so off they go then to the land of their inheritance. They say their goodbyes, and the camera doesn't stop for us to watch those goodbyes, but we can well imagine what that must have been like, the emotional intensity of that experience, and they go. But unfortunately, it's not very long before there is a problem. In fact, it appears they don't even get across the Jordan before a problem arises. And we need to consider that now. And when they came to the region, this is verse 10, and when they came to the region of the Jordan that is in the land of Canaan, the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by the Jordan, an altar of imposing size. Now, from that verse, it's not entirely clear. We know we're in the Jordan vicinity. It's not entirely clear which side it's on. I think it becomes apparent from later in the chapter that it is on the side of, here's the land, and it's on the west side. I.e., it's not in their territory. It's on the 9.5. Is that the right maths? It's on their territory. The 2.5 tribes from the east build this altar in their territory. Now, I don't know if you've ever attempted to build something on your neighbor's property, but that may not go so well. And of course, we'll come to understand why they did this, but it's not without risk, this strategy, is it? Let's just put it like that. And especially when you consider that this is an altar of imposing size, as the ESV puts it. The King James says, a great altar to see to, doesn't it? Or some expression like that. So this is a big altar. Now, we don't have the exact dimensions of it, but this is an altar that you can't miss. Now, I've no experience of altars of imposing size, but I do have an experience of a shed, a garden shed of imposing size, because one got built in our garden once. And as you probably know, in the UK, the lots for properties are much, much smaller than you have in the US. So, your neighbors are very close, and people can be quite edgy about what you put on the edge of your property, because it's close to theirs. And we had this shed built, and we got a chap to come and build it. And he was a great builder, but he used, it was way overbuilt, this shed. He used woods that is like twice as thick as the wood you would normally find in a normal shed. I think the shed will last longer than the house, probably. It was so strongly constructed. And he decided to build it on a platform of railway sleepers, which of course made it even higher. And the land sloped downwards like this, and he started the railway sleepers at the high point of the land, built up a platform so that, of course, by the time the land fell away, you know, the rise at this end with this enormous shed on it was really quite something. And we were pretty scared, actually, as we saw this, what have we done here? And what are the neighbors going to say about this? And that perhaps just highlights to us this was quite a thing for them to construct this altar of imposing size on the land that was in the territory of their brothers. And as it turned out, you know, we were sort of sat there in the evening waiting for a knock on the door, you know, from the neighbors, and it never came, and the neighbors were lovely, and everything was fine, but we were a bit anxious for a while there. Well, do you notice in verse 10, it doesn't say anything about the reason, does it? They just built this altar of imposing size, and we've got this suspense now because we don't know. It's like, why did they do that? Who is this an altar to? What is this an altar for? What is the significance of this? We don't know, and of course, the neighbors, the other tribes, they don't know either, do they? And so what's going to happen here? Well, assumptions are going to be made, aren't they? Aren't they? And that, of course, that is exactly what happens. And the people of Israel heard it, and I'm sure they saw it as well. They heard it, and they said, "Behold, the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built the altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan, in the region about the Jordan, on the side that belongs to the people of Israel." There's the clue that it's on the other, on their side. "And when the people of Israel heard of it, the whole assembly of the people of Israel gathered at Shiloh to make war against them." Oh dear. So it wasn't long since they were hugging, was it? And now there is this real risk, this clear and present danger of a civil war erupting between the tribes who now, instead of fighting against Canaanites, would be fighting against themselves. So this is something for us to take heed to, isn't it? And you know, we might think, oh, this would never happen. But of course, there are sometimes tensions between ecclesias, aren't there, within different parts of the brotherhood. While we may not be fighting physically against one another, this is indeed a situation that we might want to take heed to and see what lessons there are to be learned here. You know, if those who had been so close in their fighting together against the Canaanites, in their taking of Joshua together and so forth, could so quickly come to a situation where, through lack of proper communication and through lack of explanation of an action and understand a proper understanding of that rationale for this action, could come to the brink of civil war, then surely we too should be very careful that our actions are clearly understood and properly explained and taken for the right reasons. Then, verse 13, "The people of Israel sent to the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh in the land of Gilead, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and with him 10 chiefs, one from each tribe, every one of them ahead of the family of the clans of Israel." And they came to the 2.5 tribes. So who did they send? They sent the most scary man, didn't they? They sent Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, and we know what he had done. We know the sort of zeal for the Lord that he had had when one of the people had brought a Moabite woman and how he had struck him through. And of course, his righteous anger and his zeal was absolutely right in that occasion. So we know he's a man that's prepared to take action, and there's a risk here, though, isn't there, that could it be that the action is taken before there's been a proper discovery of what has happened? Because they're ready to make war, aren't they? That's why they've gathered at Shiloh, to make war against them, as verse 12 has told us. So let's see what they say. It starts in verse 16, doesn't it? "Thus says the whole congregation of the Lord, What is this breach of faith that you have committed against the God of Israel in turning away this day from following the Lord by building yourselves an altar this day in rebellion against the Lord? Have we not had enough of the sin of Peor? And you can feel the emotive language, can't you, now coming through here. Have we not had enough of the sin of Peor? And remember how the Lord made a breach against Achan. But there's faults on both sides here, isn't there? Because we know the story, that the 2.5 tribes have built an altar for a good reason, to remember something positive, that the altar should be a witness between the tribes of Israel, the tribes of one Israel, even though they're in two parts, one on one side of the Jordan and one on the other, to remember that they are all united under God. That was the purpose of the altar. You know, whether one was strictly needed or not is another question, but the idea of having one, it's not a bad idea, is it, to remember that unity that we have under God, so that, you know, we're not looking at ourselves and say, you know, well, you know, because I like you and you like me and we share some things, therefore it's all going to be okay, but rather we remember there is a greater one than us that unites us. And, you know, that's sort of a helpful principle, isn't it? And that can be a helpful principle in marriage and in other relationships as well, can't it? That we act in a certain way within that relationship, not just for what we are ourselves and what we have promised each other, but also because of who God is, and that He is the greater presence in all of our relationships, actually, in all of our relationships that have a spiritual basis. So all that is good and commendable. But it is a huge mistake, isn't it, to do something, especially something that can be so easily misinterpreted as it was, and not explain what it is that we're doing. And really, of course, what they should have done, rather than just, and I wonder if they weren't quite sure, perhaps they weren't quite sure whether it was a good idea or not. Perhaps they were a little bit embarrassed that the altar had ended up so big. I don't know. Perhaps they weren't sure whether they should build it on one side or the other. And they'd said, well, I think it's better if we build it on their side. But then they perhaps thought, maybe at the back of their minds, they thought, was this perhaps a bit presumptuous doing this? So instead of discussing it, they just, well, let's just do it and then walk away quickly before anyone can ask us about it. I don't know. I'm hypothesizing their thoughts and might be wrong. But what is clear in the narrative is that there has been no explanation. There has been no discussion. Surely the better thing would be to say, we're really concerned about this thing, you know, that we grow apart, and that at some future point when our fellowship together in this conquest has been, you know, long in the past, that you might start to say, you stay on your own side of Jordan, thanks. We don't want you over here. We don't want you coming to the tabernacle, you know, all the time. That they would come and explain that concern, and that together they would develop a plan, and that the brothers from the east would say, well, we thought a good way of addressing this would be if we built this altar as a witness between us. And then hopefully they would have said, yeah, that makes sense, let's do that. And then, of course, it would have been a combined altar, wouldn't it? Rather than an altar of imposing size that is imposed on the other party, because there it is in their territory built. So, in a way, there's a lot of stuff that's just common sense that is missed out here, isn't there? And as we've seen, this nearly leads to a war. So we need to think very carefully then, don't we, in ecclesial relationships about taking the right actions for the right reasons. The reasons are good here, but also thinking about how those actions will be perceived, and making sure that we explain them so that things are not misinterpreted, and that this sort of situation is avoided. On the other hand, let's think about what our brothers from the west did. Well, they're accusing them here in this speech, aren't they? Not only are they gathering for war, like, oh, well, we know how to do that, so let's do that. You know, we're good at that because we just defeated all these Canaanites. And they say through Phinehas, what is this breach of faith? So they assume and they impute to their brothers a breach of faith, which is not actually a breach of faith, is it? It's actually an expression of faithfulness and solidarity. That's what it's meant to be, slightly misconceived in its execution, but that is what it's meant to be. But it is received as and imputed to be a breach of faith and a rebellion against the Lord. So the exhortation there is for us not to rush to conclusions, isn't it? Not to assume the worst and that our brothers and sisters have somehow lost the plot and are doing something that is rebellious, not to seek to go to war against them, but instead to discuss. Now, of course, they are coming to speak. They are speaking before the war begins, so that's good. But a less tense and a less escalated discussion would have been better, wouldn't it, in the first instance? Because when you have a tense discussion like this, when one side has already mobilized itself for war, the stakes are very high, and everyone is very jittery, and everyone is very tense, and people are inclined to say things that, you know, they may not really mean, or that because their emotions are high and the hackles are up, they may regret later. These are all the characteristics of human nature. So that trying to de-escalate would have made the situation of less risk than what we see here. Well, let's look at the response of the people of Reuben in verse 22. This is how they respond. The mighty one, God the Lord, the mighty one, God the Lord, he knows. That's very powerful, isn't it? It begins with God. So let's bring God back to the start of the conversation and not just said once. Let's say it again to remind ourselves that we are in his presence and that we are acting to do the best we can in his sight. The mighty one, God the Lord, the mighty one, God the Lord, he knows. And of course, that is true. He does know, doesn't he? He does know the motives for our actions and the thoughts underlying them. But we need to let our brothers and sisters know as well. And that's what they say next. And let Israel itself know. Like, it would have been good if they'd done that before, but at least they're doing it now. If it was in rebellion or in breach of faith against the Lord, then do not spare us today. For in building an altar to turn away from following the Lord, that is not what they've done. No, verse 24, but we did it from fear that in time to come your children might say to our children, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Jordan is there as a barrier between us. So distance can create barriers, can't it? And then, you know, discussions can happen and interpretations can grow up and things can be attributed to other sides where you're not actually close to the situation. Do you notice that they did it in fear, didn't they? They built the altar because they were afraid. We've already seen examples throughout Joshua 1 to 12 of when things are done in fear. And usually what people did in fear wasn't good, was it? That was what caused Jericho to be shut in. That was what caused the kings of the north and the kings of the south to gather together and form a coalition to fight against Israel. It didn't end well. The only people who got it right in fear were the people of Gibeon, who turned to the Lord, although in a scheming way, and of course Rahab herself, who saw the fear of her people and decided that she would act. So that's a real thing, isn't it? To recognize it, to we probably don't like to admit that when we're afraid of something, do we? But it's useful to spot it in ourselves, to be self-aware enough to know that we are frightened of something, and then to be able to articulate what it is, and therefore then discuss and agree what the best strategy is of avoiding the thing of which we are afraid, if indeed it is a legitimate thing to be afraid of. Sometimes we're afraid of things we shouldn't be afraid of, aren't we? And hopefully discussing it would, you know, would help that to become established, if that were the case also. Well, I think we don't need to read the rest of the speech. Verse, just a couple of things. Verse 28. And we thought, that sort of says it all, doesn't it? Well, you may think that, but you need to explain that. And therefore, they built this altar. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn this day from following Him by building an altar against Him. So, the situation now, having given this really quite wise speech now, well, things are straightened out, aren't they? And you can just imagine everyone taking it, just breathing out a relief that there does not now have to be this fighting of the 9.5 tribes against the 2.5, but they can all remain in the fellowship that they had enjoyed in all those previous adventures they'd undertaken together. So it was, you can see that in verse 30 and 31. Let's look at the words at the end of verse 31. Today we know that the Lord is in our midst, because you have not committed this breach of faith against the Lord. Now you have delivered the people of Israel from the hand of the Lord. And on into verse 33, the people of Israel blessed God and spoke no more of making war against them to destroy the land where the people of Reuben and the people of Gad were settled. The people of Reuben and the people of Gad called the altar Witness, Ed, or Ed for short, for they said, it is a witness between us that the Lord is God. So again, that principle of having something greater than ourselves, and we see that on a number of times in the Bible, don't we, when people set up a stone or a pillar, or there is an altar and a sacrificing in the presence of the Lord, and the two parties remember perhaps what unites them, they remember their responsibilities towards one another, but that they have those responsibilities and that they will be faithful, not because of what they believe about themselves and not because of what they believe about the other party, but because of what they believe about God, the Lord God. He is witness. So very interesting, incident, isn't it, in Joshua 22 that exhorts us quite powerfully in our relationships with one another. So when we say our goodbyes today, no civil wars afterwards. That's the thing that we've got to remember. On into chapter 23 then and 24, and we're in our final two chapters of Joshua. Let's just remind ourselves of how that begins. A long time afterward, when the Lord had given rest from all the surrounding enemies, and Joshua was old and well advanced in years, Joshua summoned all Israel, and he spoke to them those final words. I want really perhaps to just pull out, We won't go through all of chapter 23 and 24. There's a lot in those chapters. They're very rich chapters. But let's just make the connection back with chapter 1 and, again, our theme of succession. Because now it's Joshua's turn for one last time, or I suppose really two last times, once in chapter 23 and once in chapter 24, to remind them of their responsibilities, to remind them of the treasure that they bear as God's children and as His servants, to remind them of their responsibilities to take heed to the commandments of the Lord and to make sure they are passed on. These are not suggestions of the Lord, are they? These are the commands of the Lord. And to go forth in the knowledge that God will be with them as they go, and that they may therefore be strong and courageous to do all that he has commanded them. So we return then to that topic of passing the baton, of one generation passing on the truth to another, and of the importance of Bible schools within that. Of course, they have a very important role to play, don't they? And we've all been blessed by being able to share in such an occasion together this week. We looked in our first class at some examples of how the times change, but the word of the Lord must abide forever amongst us. And we talked about COVID, we talked about technology, didn't we? We talked about the passing of the generations from the old to the young. And I just wanted to give one more example. I gave the example of our individual ecclesia and at Stirling, and how there was a point when, you know, there was a real transition when a number of brothers and sisters who had served so long and so actively fell asleep, and it was time for a new generation to arise. I want to give a broader example now of how things change and how opportunities arise. We've been lamenting, I suppose, in the UK for a number of years about the way in which the community is aging, and of course the struggles which I think we all are experiencing in the Western world with the temptations of this world, with the strong cultural messages that are increasingly forced into our lives through media and through the education system, and so on. And I think perhaps if we were to go back, say 10 years or something like that, there was something of a spirit of despondency of just how quickly the community was aging and actually shrinking. And you know, I don't want to overplay that. There are still lots of really strong ecclesias, and you know, there are lots of young people coming into the faith and being baptized. There's lots of preaching work carrying on. Nevertheless, despite that, if you were just to look at the demographic profile, it was still the case that this aging and this shrinking was happening. It would be easy to get depressed by that, and wouldn't it? And you know, to become kind of down and heavy feeling, and you know, sort of perhaps even to think despondent thoughts. And no one could really see a particularly, you know, of course we've all got to keep trying, we've all got to keep preaching, we've all got to teach our children and encourage them. Yes, of course, all those things must come. But nobody saw that there would really be any kind of a turning of the tide of those general trends. In human terms, it was difficult to see that. Here we are today in 2023, and in the meantime, more than 2,500 Iranian brothers and sisters have been baptized in the UK. That's an astonishing number, isn't it? It's like we had no idea that was going to come, no idea whatsoever. That suddenly there would be that, first of all, a trickle, and then it came and it came and it came, and now seems like a flood of opportunity. And of course it brings challenges, and you know, it's disruptive and all of that. But isn't it an incredible thing how God can bring things that we are not expecting at all and give us opportunities that we are not expecting. And this is a new set of challenges, the integration of culture and the welfare and all other aspects of that, and the language barrier and so on. Those things all need to be thought through. That it's hard work thinking them through. We don't always get it right. In fact, often we get it wrong. All of that. But in this new situation that we have for so many ecclesias, there is opportunity, isn't there? And the same word that was preached to Abraham and to David and in the earlier history of our community, the word that was preached through the apostles, it can still go out in this new situation, and it is still powerful to accomplish that to which God sends it. And that's really something that is emphasized strongly in the book of Joshua. Can we just go back briefly to chapter 1 before we come back for one final time to chapters 23 and 24? This was a part that we didn't consider when we looked at chapter 1. let's come in at verse 6. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all that the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Now, it's interesting there, isn't it? It's like twice is the exhortation to be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous. This is about going in and doing something physical. This is about, you know, fighting the war of the Lord. That's going to be one element, isn't it? And of setting up new structures and new housing and new encampments and so forth in the land. There's going to be a lot to be done, and we can understand why it says be strong and courageous. That's an attribute that is going to be very much needed. But there is also to be a care, isn't there? We parked that in Joshua 22. We noted that, didn't we? Be very careful to do according to the law. So what we don't want then is a sort of a bull in a china shop the sort of thing here, then. The bull is the be strong, isn't there? But it must be a strength with care. That strength must be tempered with carefulness. Be careful to do according to all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. So he talks about the danger that we might turn to the left or turn to the right. And, obviously within the political sphere, those are terms, aren't there? There is a left and a right. And there is this balance then, isn't there, of walking this line that is focused on what God has said and being careful to avoid an extreme at the left and the right. And I just think that's captured in the nature of God himself, that he is a God of mercy and truth, isn't he? And that those two things are perfectly balanced in him. And it may be that, you know, as a person, your personal character may gravitate more towards one than the other. You know, there are some people who are very focused on the mercy and the forgiveness and the love, aren't there? And there's some people who are much more focused on, well, this is what it says. This is the law with the righteousness and the judgment. But God is not a God of one or the other of these things, is he? So whatever our personal temperament might happen to be, there is a balance to be found here in which, because if it was all one or all the other, it wouldn't work, would it? Because, you know, if God just says, oh, sure, go ahead, do whatever you like, it doesn't really matter, you know, that doesn't work. That's not how you bring up good children, is it? By saying, do whatever you want to do. Because basically you're then saying that truth doesn't matter, that it's all the same. And it's not all the same, is it? Because God is a God who divides. So it can't all be about love and forgiveness and mercy and grace. But at the same time, it can't all be about truth and righteousness either, can it? Because we'd all be dead, and there wouldn't be any hope if it was fairness in that sense, you know, sort of Shylock the Jews kind of fairness about the literal pound of flesh. We're not going anywhere with that, are we? And it's the balancing of the mercy and the truth, which of course God has perfectly in his character, and which careful study and attention to the scriptures will lead us to, by God's grace, develop within ourselves, that is key there. Verse 8, the book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful, there it is again, to do according to all that is written within it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. So here it is at the beginning of Joshua 1, this emphasis on the primacy of the word of God. And lo and behold, there it is in our statement of faith, isn't it, as the very first clause. So we're absolutely right with that, aren't we, in laying that foundation in the statement of faith, because you can't have a discussion or an understanding of anything else unless you have a basis for understanding truth. And that's why, of course, it has to be first in the statement of faith, as it is. It shall not depart from our mouth, and we shall meditate on it day and night. And you remember when we looked at, well, it was a late night class, so a lot of you won't remember, but we looked at the three parts of the Old Testament in the Jewish Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, because they organize the books quite differently, and that was the original way of ordering them, the way that the Jews do it. And of course, you have the law and the prophets and the writings, and the law begins with Genesis, and the prophets begins with Joshua, and the writings begins with Psalms. And in the first chapter of every one of those three sections of the Jewish Bible, you know, the Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, law, prophets, writings, you have in chapter one of Genesis, the divine fiats. We remember those, don't we? The ten, and God said, the importance of the word of God. Let there be. Let it be as God has said, not as we would like to think it is or should be. So there's the word of God in Genesis 1. And we come to Joshua 1, and here we have this. Meditate on it day and night. Let it not depart out of your mouth. And what do we have in Psalm 1? But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law does he meditate day and night. It's like a quote from Joshua 1, isn't it, that we have in the first psalm there. So in each of those components then of the Old Testament, there is this reminder that our understanding of God and his truth comes from God speaking to us in his word, and that's why we seek to give it the pride of place that we do, because he has something to say, and it's our responsibility to listen. We could just have, just on our way back to the end of Joshua, let's just quickly stop in chapter 8. And towards the end of the chapter, Joshua renews the covenant with Israel. And he writes on the stones a copy of the law of Moses. And Israel gathers themselves together on opposite sides of the ark before the Levitical priests. That's in verse 33. And then in verse 34, and afterward he read all the words of the law, the blessing and the curse. Here's the two sides, isn't it, of God's character, the mercy and the truth, the blessing and the curse, according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses commanded that Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel, and the women, and the little ones, and the sojourners who lived among them. All were to know, weren't they? All were to understand, and all had the potential to respond, to hear and to respond to the words of God. And there's no shyness about using a double negative here, is there? There was not a word of all that Moses commanded that Joshua did not read. Trying to get that complete picture, that rich understanding with all the nuances of what it is that God has to say to us. And so let's gather our thoughts together and conclude in Joshua 23 and 24. So 23 now and verse 6. Therefore, be very strong to keep and to do all that is written in the book of law, the law of Moses, turning aside from it neither to the right hand nor to the left. It's almost verbatim, isn't it, from chapter 1. These are bookends that frame the book of Joshua and that remind us of our responsibilities. And what will the How will this work itself out? Verse 7, that you may not mix with those nations remaining among you, nor make mention of the names of their gods, or swear by them, or serve them, or bow down to them. But you shall cling to the Lord your God, just as you have done to this day. And as the covenant is renewed here for the people of Israel, we've got that. Here's our wedding, isn't it, that we didn't have a chance to talk about in the first talk, and it's really expanded more fully in chapter 24 when the covenant is made, and Joshua says, are you going to commit to the Lord And you can sort of hear the marriage echoes in that. And they say yes. And Joshua says, "Are you sure you're going to commit to him?" And you can imagine this happening in a real, in a human marriage. "You sure you really want to marry that guy?" "Yeah, yes, I do." "No, really, really. Are you sure?" And this happens four times. And four times Israel say, "We will commit. We understand what this is, and we want to do it. We want to be part of it. We want to hear it. And with the strength that God provides, we want to go in and obtain the blessing and the inheritance that he has promised. We want to cling to him. He is our Lord and our God. And of course, we look forward to the time when he sends his great son, the Lord Jesus Christ, back to the earth again as a bridegroom. And in the meantime, we prepare ourselves for him as his beloved bride.